your tangible assets advisor. This is Kevin Walter, your host. True Wealth is always brought to you by Coins Plus in Spokane, Washington. Coins Plus has been doing business since the mid-90s. That's over two solid decades. We've done a tremendous amount of business over the years, buying and selling. It's a lot, and I don't want to sound braggadocious, but we really have been blessed. Our business started out absolutely for the Lord, by the Lord, and it's been that way ever since. We've been incredibly blessed. We're incredibly fortunate. I guess it's kind of interesting. As a believer, you have accountability to God that is different than a non-believer. Or as God's chosen people, you know, when we were in Israel and we had the ultimate tour guide, this Ronnie Simon, who Ken Ortiz is known forever, a general in the Mossad, PhD in Israeli history, just absolutely, totally intelligent. And he was really specifying how the history. Now, you know, he's technically not a Christian, I guess, and we won't get into that because there's a lot of personal stuff that he may be and just can't admit it in front of certain people and where he's at. But the one of many things that stuck out to me, one of them was that Israel had, the blessings, and I don't want to use the word cursings, but let's do it because they've had some brutal beatings, haven't they? The blessings and cursings of the Jews, a.k.a. the nation of Israel, has been directly proportional, congruent with their obedience and service towards God. Okay? So that is really reflective upon all of us. We've had our ups, our downs, our goods, our bads, but it's really our heart and it's our repetitive behavior. God tells us to tithe. He says you want to be blessed financially, you got to tithe. Tithe is 10%. Now, one thing we all struggle with is what's the difference? If I give 10% to this ministry, if I take 10% of my income and I give some to this ministry and that ministry and this ministry, that's still 10%. I don't know what the difference is, but God says in Malachi 3, you know, you ask, how have you robbed God? And he says, in your tithes and offerings, okay? Tithes and means plus. When you study logic, and is plus. So it's your tithes plus your offerings. It's not your tithes or your offerings, it's one big batch. And so we've seen that over the years personally. It's kind of weird. It's like when I started the business and I wanted, I talked to pastors and Christian friends and I was just like, God had put me in this business and I wanted to know, how do you tithe on a brand new business that's made no income? I mean, the advice I got from everyone was to tithe based on what God gives you. Tithe based on the growth of the business or the revenue generated. For some reason, probably because God built the business from the ground up, it was just a series of impossible miracles. For some reason, I just knew, no, you tithe on what you want to make. And I can just say that I tithe a certain amount a month. That was way more than I ever would have ever been able to. And I made my first full fiscal year in business more than I'd ever made in corporate America. Now, does that mean we, are just making a killing? No. It means that God blesses you. And the other thing that happens is, that God builds a spring of wealth. He tells you that. Overflowing. Okay? And then he says he rebukes the devourer. Now, that just baffles me. What does he mean? I rebuke the devourer. You think about it for a minute, and it's like, okay, you're like, that's no big deal. Okay, he doesn't say, I'll protect you if the devourer shows up. He says, I will rebuke the devourer. What in the world is the devourer? So, I don't mean to pause for too long, but I want you to think about it. The devourer is natural law, okay? We've got physical law. You've got the laws of thermodynamics, right? We've got that. We'll look that up here. get that going, eh? So we've got the laws of thermodynamics, the physical laws. We've got the laws of Newton, right? We've got the laws of thermodynamics, which are, you know, there's basically three laws of thermodynamics. You know, to simplify, when energy passes as work or heat, you know, basically the systems, I won't get into it. It's basically saying that there's energy lost, okay, in any machine. That's why the theory of a perpetual motion machine of what they call the first kind is impossible, at least by what we know, okay? So the first law of thermodynamics is that, I'll read it in their terms, when energy passes as work, as heat, or with other matter, or into or out of a system, the system's internal energy changes in accord with the law of the conservation of energy. Equivalently, perpetual motion machines of the first kind, machines that produce work with no energy input, are impossible. So you have to put energy in to get energy out. There's no system that is self-perpetuating, okay? So that's physical. The second law is the simple law of the second law of thermodynamics is entropy, the law of entropy. And it says in a natural thermodynamic process, which is our universe, the sum of the entropies of the interacting thermodynamic systems increases. Equivalently, perpetual motion machines of the second kind, machines that spontaneously convert thermal energy into mechanical work, are impossible. In other words, everything breaks down. The more work energy you put into it, the more motors or more pulleys or more whatever, you're losing more and more and more. One system can lose so much energy, but the more multiple systems can lose more. And that it's just physics stuff I've studied long ago. And the third law of thermodynamics is another entropy law. The entropy of a system approaches a constant value as the temperature approaches absolute zero. With the exception of the non-crystalline solids, glasses, the entropy of a system at absolute zero is typically close to zero. So, and what they're getting at there is zero is Kelvin zero, not Fahrenheit zero. Kelvin zero is the absolute mass scale, or the scientific scale, universal scientific scale of temperature measurement. So 273 degrees below zero is absolute zero. That becomes Kelvin zero, okay? And so all they're saying, which means nothing to you or me, but it, you know, it basically says that the slower, you know, the molecules are moving, the colder something gets, the closer it gets to a zero loss of entropy. So, or zero entropy or loss of, you know, energy. So the bottom line is outer space is in many spots is close to absolute Kelvin zero, which is 273 degrees below zero Fahrenheit. Just in case you're wondering, that's pretty cold. People don't make it through that one. You can put on your 4 foot thick down jacket. Nah, not making it through that. It's going to destroy everything on you. Interesting, as a side note, my specialty, during the Great Flood, the scientific evidence that I rely on and believe, when the outer ice firmament was shattered, it sucked in through convection, the hot air. We had a lot of greenhouse gases back then, you know, the old CO2 fears. Nah, there's so much evidence. They have it, you know, 300 million years ago, but it wasn't. But we had a lot of that. So that as that hot air escapes, right, you have a closed system, an atmospheric system, you get convection, and it sucks in that ice cold air. What does cold air do? Cold air goes down, hot air goes up. So that cold air in outer space, once that got shattered by meteorites or whatever, that cold air came shooting down to Earth. It's interesting, this weekend I was reading these, you know, the contradictions of climate change and global warming and what the views are, and you know, just, oh my gosh, the web is so full of rubbish. But I was reading all these guys trying to solve what they called the woolly mammoth phenomenon. Well, the woolly mammoth phenomenon is where these great big hairy mastodon type creatures with massive tusks are found standing upright, frozen to death, buried in ice, chewing on food. Literally everything's still fresh in them, right? Their skin, even in central Montana, they've found areas in the last couple decade or last decade where, I mean, there's dinosaurs and mastodons that are through the freeze thaw, they're coming up through the dirt, and their skin is, their flesh is still moist because somehow it was preserved. And then again, we do have global warming. Hate to break the news to you. You look at Glacier National Park, 1911, Glacier National Park today, you go from massive glaciers to what they call glacierettes. They say that by 2030, they're going to be gone. And then you go liberal, and it's all our fault. We did it all to ourselves. And then they say, oh, the argument that there's been freezing and cooling throughout all of the, you know, scientific history of the Earth, which is all 100 billion, you know, whatever, not. They're basically looking at temperature fluctuations, you know, at least, well, for sure, over the last 6,000 years of man's presence, but also beforehand. You know, I don't believe in the 6,000-year Earth theory. Oops, sorry. I have my theories based on a lot of biblical research. Doesn't have any bearing on God's word. Just as a disclaimer, it says, in the beginning, God created what? The heavens and the earth. The entire magnitude of everything you see. That's the intro. In the beginning. Or in the beginning, the word was with God and the word was God. And then what he said, what's he tells us, that's the granddaddy beginning. Then it says, and then the word became flesh. And then, right? In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And then the world was without form and void. It was tohu and bohu, devastated, destroyed, absolutely wrecked. And then God rebuilt it. That's just my quick side note. I mean, that creates the creation of mankind and life as we know it, absolutely. But when you start to work with the flood afterwards, tectonic plate shifting, massive mountain ranges, you know, the days of Peleg. I mean, you read in the Bible alone that, you know, what happened after the flood, it was incredible. I mean, he talks about David in, is it Psalms? Let me see here. Psalms 124, maybe. Cross your fingers. Here we go. Okay, here we go. Wow, I got lucky. So Psalms 124, a song of ascents of David. Had it not been the Lord who was on our side, let Israel now say, had it not been the Lord who was on our side when men rose up against us, then they would have swallowed us alive when their anger was kindled against us. And then he goes into this. Then the waters would have engulfed us. The stream would have swept over our soul. Then the raging waters. Oh, no, this isn't it. It actually talks about the mountains rising up and putting a barrier or, you know, or keeping them within their boundary. I got to see if I can find that. But anyway, it's so where I'm going with that in, sorry for, this may be it. It may have been 104. Yes, I believe I found it here. Okay, he makes the winds his messengers, flaming fire his ministers. He established the earth upon its foundations so that it will not totter forever and ever. Wow, what does that mean? Totter. You got to be kidding me, right? Yeah. Totter means to wobble, shake, slip. Folks, excuse me, but do you realize, David apparently knew that the tilt of the Earth's axis was at a 5-degree tilt. That's the tottering of the spinning. So something about, you know, who knows if it was their astronomy or what, but they had a interesting thing. And so he says, you covered it with the deep as with a garment. That's the water. That's the waters were standing above the mountains. Okay, there's the flood. At your rebuke, they fled. At the sound of your thunder, they hurried away. Well, what makes thunder? Two things. Thunder hadn't rained before. Now it's raining. But also thunder comes from earthquakes and volcanoes. And there was a lot going on there. At your rebuke, they fled. At the sound of your thunder, they hurried away. Listen to this. This is important. The mountains rose and the valleys sank down to the place where you established for them. Okay, so he's telling us that with the tectonic plate shifting, after he rebuked, you know, everything, and it fled. The mountains rose, the valleys sank down to the place which you established for them. You set, and this is important, so now you've got mountains rising up. This is what Genesis says happened. You know, that God says, land here, stay here. The mountains are rising up. All this water that came, first thing it tells us is the water broke forth from the deep. And it inundated. There's so much of it. The whole form of the earth changed. We had water underneath us somehow. And then during the flood, we had all these, or post-flood, I guess, or during and post, we had all these new continents being formed. We know Pangaea now. We take everything always from a static consistency point, which is, we never look at catastrophism in science, which is foolish. But they take Pangaea, which would have been like a round continent, essentially, and then it spins apart, and you can spin it back together. It's pretty phenomenal. You've looked at all the continents. They fit. That's not a coincidence. God did some pretty cool stuff. I mean, you know, we're so little, tiny, insignificant, we don't even know all the functions and features of the earth. Like, I buy these, I like really nice watches. Well, for years I collected Rolexes, and I have Sky Dwellers and Sea Dwellers, and I've got Yacht Masters, and all of them have all these crazy functions and features. And once in a while, I'll be wearing one, and someone who knows them will go, hey, did you know it does this? And they'll grab the bezel and twist it to number 5 and pull out one button and push in another, and all of a sudden, you know, the whole watch face is moving and it's keeping track of all this stuff. And I'm like, whoa, I didn't know it did that. I just knew it was cool. So it's the same with the features and functions of God's earth. You know, he knows if you throw a few meteorites at it, at this point, we got water under the continents, but then they're going to go up and we're going to get the mountains and we're going to do this. And, you know, he knows. This is like to us, it looks like a rough-hewn, rough-shod creation, because we make everything with sharp, even corners. And even if our architects build something, everything's round and smooth. Even if they get crazy, there's smooth edges, and right? Not God, because his comprehension of beauty and magnificence is so far beyond ours, and incredibleness. And he creates dirt, you know, that we can use and dig and build, and it fills trees with fertilizer or nutrients and supplements to grow, and photosynthesis. And so it's not going to look all perfectly smooth and hard like a nice painted piece of wood, you know. That's not his creation. That's the way it is. But then he also tells us, so the mountains rose. We knew that. The valleys sunk to the place where you established for them. And then this is kind of interesting. You set a boundary that they may not pass over it, so they will not return to cover the earth. That's a key word. You set a boundary that they may not pass over it. They got really, really tall. He's saying God made the mountains so tall that there can't be a global flood anymore, because the water will be blocked and controlled and filtered and routed and this kind of stuff. That's what the rising is. So when you have, you know, when they go look at archaeological sites, I mean, there's crazy places in South America, way down south, that are nuts. They've got all these massive, like Makawasi, these massive man-made, you know, statues that are 30, 40 feet high, but they're 14,000 feet above sea level, and they're pointing kind of at a 30-degree south angle. Well, that, you know, obviously they wouldn't have ever done that then, but now, you know, it probably was sea level, and it was in a different location. And then there's all these underground catacombs and stuff. But so they, you know, it rose up, the earth moved, and all of a sudden it carried these great big pre-flood creations with it, solid stone things that are, you know, they look at them, they've been heavily weathered, and it's just your typical South American stuff, just like all the pyramids all over South America, you know, that are now mountains, and they dig into a mountain and go, oh, it's not a mountain, it's a pyramid. They found one in Peru about 8 years ago that was the largest pyramid on earth, unbelievably, and more ornate than you can imagine. And they can't find the way into it, but the outside is gorgeous, you know. So there was they just ended up in these obscure locations where they're covered with jungle. No one would be there now. I mean, let's face it, you couldn't even get into these places now. So something changed. So anyway, basically what's, I guess where I'm left kind of walk or leaving this is, so the boundary is that there's so much stuff going through my mind because of a scientific background. The temperature and atmospheric pressure of Earth allows us to live in the condition where the most important product, I guess, the most important thing on Earth is water. The most important thing for life, probably universally, would be water because of its unique properties and principles that we know of. Those properties and principles exist on our planet under our gravitational situation, but we have also taken them into outer space. So we know they're, you know, more universal principles. But basically what I'm getting at is God has put us in this prime situation where water goes from solid to liquid to gas, all within a small spectrum, all based on atmospheric pressure. That's why if you go higher in a mountain, water boils quicker, okay? And, you know, so the atmospheric pressure affects it. But the point of that is this. If you think about, if you've ever worked with like acetone or rubbing alcohol, and it doesn't stay in a container, it doesn't have turgor, surface pressure that tightens it up and keeps it down. That's because it's prime, state, prime temperature, where it can transition from solid to liquid to gas is much, much lower than Earth. So when it's on Earth, it splishes and splashes all over. And you can have, I've had acetone, you know, where I've used it to remove glue off of stuff or something in a little dish, and it'll splash all the way up over the side. And I'm like, what is this stuff? Well, water would never do that. Well, that's another thing where God set a boundary. You have this atmospheric pressure situation. You've got these mountains built. God's created an earth that cannot be flooded again, so we don't have to worry about it. But it's just cool how everything is so designed and so planned, and he just ends so that they will not cover the earth, okay? So that's just, I think that was something I kind of was, I did a little more research this weekend, but you know, on the global warming thing, there's appears to be, you know, global warming. But historically, there's been so many things that happened. And this whole theory that, oh, you know, the earth is going to get covered by water. We're all going to die. Now, you think we're that dumb? I mean, first of all, go look at a map. Look at the polar ice caps. You really think the polar ice caps could fill up the whole earth with water? Sorry, not going to happen. They're trying to predict and prophesy the flood of Noah again, falsely, you know. And what happens if a prophet in the Bible proves to be wrong? What do you do with them? You stone them to death, okay? So here's what you get from the Democrats all the time. You get Al Gore, you know, Inconvenient Truth. The whole world by 2012 is going to be covered. We're going to lose a fourth of the population or whatever he said. On and on and on. He made $1 billion. He was the first green billionaire. So, wait a minute. That's a prophecy. And what about, the Dems? Whenever, you know, they try to block Obamacare. Oh, you're going to kill 20 million senior citizens. Oh, we're going to have a taper off program on Social Security. Oh, you're going to kill all these elderly people. Obamacare is bad. Oh, and then they have to have commercials with Paul Ryan shoving grandma over the cliff in a wheelchair. This is the concepts. This is what they do all the time. So these are prophecies. They're saying, if you do this, they do it all the time. If you do this, all these people are going to die. Well, they're false prophets. Every time they prove to be wrong. What blows my mind is that obviously I'm biased and skewed. And what blows my mind is that people listen to this stuff and they literally absorb it. I've gone to competitive type news. You know, I've tried to listen to fake CNN or CNN fake news, whatever it's called. And I can't. My spirit is like, wow. But people who don't know any better, maybe, they're getting that stuff. You could never support Trump. They're gathering all this evidence to impeach him and all evidence. Sorry I said that word. There's no evidence. They're gathering all this momentum to impeach him. It's all sentimental. And it's all based on hype and emotion and conjecture and propaganda. And it's bad. I mean, our country is in bad shape, you know. And so I wanted to cover, you know, I got so many different things I could do. How about today we look at something here about leadership? So first of all, I want to talk a little bit about that. What is leadership? You go to the definition here, noun, the action of leading, keyword, a group of people or an organization or the state or position of being a leader or the leaders of an organization, etc. When I say leadership, what do I mean? I'm basically talking, okay, in contrast to controlling, I am thinking of leadership as the art of motivating people or a group of people or whatever to act, you know, to achieve a common goal if you're known as a leader, or, you know, it basically is inspiring other people. And you don't always do it on purpose. You if you live a good life and you're a good person and you do what you want or do what you love, do what you're passionately driven to with, you know, with sincerity. That's the thing, sincerity. You know, you're serious about what you do. You're doing your best all the time. You're just always pushing yourself. People get, oh, that's so exhausting. I don't want to always do my best. Once in a while I will, but no, you won't, because you either do or you don't at what you do. And a lot of times those of us who drive physically can actually be overdriven mentally, where you're trying to take on too many things too fast and you end up doing none of them well. You end up crashing is what happens. So the point of leadership is that it is an action. It's you lead by example as believers. This is, you know, they call it lifestyle evangelism. And that's, you know, that's the word. But it's lifestyle leadership. It's showing people who you are, what you're about, how to live your life. And we've all run into different denominations and sects that'll, SCCTS, that is, that will promote or present, exhibit a very strong, good works lifestyle. You know, they'll have communities of these people and different, you know, they're just different, you know what I mean, different sects of professed Christians. But then when you get to know them to a certain point, all of a sudden the hammer comes down. They want you to be one of them. And the problem is you go, oh, I'm actually a born-again believer. I have a great relationship with Jesus Christ. I read his word every day. That's not good enough. You got to be part of our group. And the thing is with the group, they get this, you know, these some of these religions, they get big, big bucks. They're one of the bigger corporations in the world, some of them. And then, you know, they have, I mean, when you look at some of these organizations where, you know, you look at like the Catholic Church, okay? I'm certainly not going to profess to, you know, say they're straight up in any way. They actually have a lot of issues, bad. But they also have good people, and they have churches, or I'm sorry, they have hospitals. They have hospices. They have all kinds of special care clinics. They have ministries. They have everything. They are serving. They're, you know, there's so many Catholics, they're following the Great Commission. And it's important, you know, if they love Jesus, that's it. I mean, I know, you know, there's, like I said, the 13 or the Apostles' Creed, those 13 items that work and that are doctrinally fundamental. After that, the rest is just rubbish. But the point is you'll see these Baptist and Presbyterian hospitals and all kinds of ministerial activity. And then all of a sudden you run into these other massive cults. And or as some used to call them, or they won't now or don't, but they'll be showing themselves as Christians and believers, but where is their ministry? They don't have anything out there, nothing. I mean, even globally, but they're all over the world. They're doing missions all the time. They have missionaries all the time. They're always dressed up nice, but they adapt to the climate. They adapt to the geography and the demography and theology of where they're doing their missions. But in those cases, they're always converting. But when, like I said, other than educational facilities, which helps to captivate the brain, you won't see them investing a lot of their money into philanthropic activities. We'll just say that. And that's just something to think about. That's a different kind. That's not really leadership. That's control. They're getting people into the church. They're getting their money out of them. They're controlling them. They're forcing them to be part of it. I've been around those types of situations where people try to get out or get married to someone who's in and won't, they don't want to get in. And it becomes Gestapo-like. And they also have a lot of weird rituals and things like that. So anyhow, that is an example of non-leadership spirituality. Leadership spirituality is where you are essentially living a lifestyle. Well, let me back that up. Each one of us has, and I've said this before, each one of us has a sphere of authority, a sphere of influence, a sphere of responsibility. Now, you might look and say, mine isn't, I don't have a sphere. I'm stuck in the basement of some state building running a ticker tape, you know, or 10 key, and I've only got three people that even ever come down there. Well, there's three people. That's what God wants to see. You don't need to be preaching and pushing, but you live right. You speak right. You speak good. And folks, we all have our different weaknesses, challenges. Mine is definitely my tongue. I talk a lot. And guess what? The more where speech is plentiful, sin will, I don't want to say abound. I don't think that's scripture, but sin will definitely be present, you know? And so as another side note, when you get the differences in personalities, what you'll run into sometimes is you'll have somebody who's a lot more verbal or verbose than the other in a marriage or relationships or whatever. The people who sit back and say nothing will oftentimes criticize those who say something or do something. Those who do nothing will sit on the sidelines and criticize those who do something. There's the people that will watch a fireman run into a burning building and to save a child, and this happened a few years ago, where he dropped the child out of a window and then proceeded to, well, his buddy caught him for the most part. The child, she was hurt a little bit, but then he ended up with third-degree burns afterwards getting out of the house. So they came after him. The media said, oh, he mishandled this child and all that stuff. And they absolutely came down on this guy. And then all of a sudden, they find out he is in intensive care, the intensive care unit, with third-degree burns. He dropped this girl out the window. The flames were so hot, he had no other option. And then he himself had to run through the flames with all of his fire-retardant material and clothing, and he got third-degree burns, folks. Third degree is where your skin, all of it, is burnt crisp off. You're down to the raw flesh. You're down to muscle. That is terrible. But, you know, the point is that guy sacrificed his life, and then he was under criticism for this kind of stuff. And, you know, that's where we need to know the truth about what's going on. We need to just live. The truth will prevail. We're seeing things in politics that make you really question otherwise. But that right there, that's incredible leadership. Who cares what people think? Who cares how it looks? He saved that girl's life. He made a snap decision and said, you know what? If that girl breaks her leg, it's a lot better than being dead. And then he went and he had to have skin grafts. The whole story was tremendous. And the media, you know, they still had people bickering back and forth whether he should have dropped the girl out of the window. I mean, is that our job, is to sit and you know, they call it Monday morning quarterback or armchair quarterback or second base coach, or, you know, is that our job to sit in second base coach a guy who's a professional in that situation? Another thing, too, as far as our perceptions go, Dunning and Kruger, major study, you can look it up, Dunning and Kruger, a major study on cognitive misperceptions, okay? So the nice way they put it is the least capable people, or less capable, less competent. In other words, people who don't have skyrocketing IQs, and these are the people who will not take advice from those with big IQs. Why? Because the people with low IQs, this is proven scientifically now, people with low IQs believe that the people that are very intelligent are the same level of intelligence as them. They don't know what they don't know. They can't comprehend what they don't know. They lack wisdom, because wisdom automatically assumes better about everybody. It assumes there's a nugget of wisdom and wonder in each and every man. You can talk to anybody. You can go, I mean, you want to get some wisdom, go down and find a junkie, a heroin addicted street person that's there, not because of just you know, choice, but I mean, because of fallenness. You want wisdom, simplistic wisdom? I've gone down and ministered to those people. They'll wake you up. And people say, well, you don't take advice from a drunk about drinking. Oh, really? Well, that's not exactly the way I look at it. You get a guy that's on Skid Row and he's like, whatever you do, kid, do not ever touch the bottle. And you're like, oh, yeah, right, old man, you're an alky. And then 25 years later, they're doing it too or something. Who knows? We all have a sphere of influence. Every stinking one of us has a sphere of influence. God gives it to us. If we're faithful with little, we'll be given much. Parable of talents. I go there every time. I love it. It just speaks loud. God made it so clear because it has to do with our talents and money all together in one. What do we use our talents for? To earn money. What does socialism do? It tries to take away our talents and our money. Pure capitalism allows us to utilize our talents to create wealth. Create wealth. Remember that. Not steal someone's money. That's what these crazy liberals are acting like, man, this has been going on since Obama. You didn't build that. And they created the 1%, that nasty, evil, filthy, rotten 1%. Now, Elizabeth Warren, she doesn't care about the 1%. She just cares about the one top one half of 1%. We've got to vilify those rotten people. You go back in history, folks. Look at the ploys of the socialistic tyrants throughout history. You know, even Hitler was one of them, by the way. People say, no, he wasn't. Yeah, he absolutely was hardcore. But you look at the speeches, they're always the same. Those evil, rotten one percenters. And then you've always got to have someone on the side to have a war. You got to take the money from the top. And then you got to go fight these evil people that are trying to destroy you. You got to have that all the time. That's not leadership. That is head games and head control. Okay? So I've got a couple different things. I've got this Jocko Willink, who was a master sergeant, I believe, at least, in the Navy SEALs. Really phenomenal guy. Incredible stuff. He's got a book called Extreme Ownership, how U.S. Navy SEALs lead and win. I want to say real quick, I know SEALs, I know Rangers and Delta Force guys, and I'll tell you what, this guy's book is not at all about self-braggadocia, okay? We've got, you know, that Chris, I don't remember his name now, that put out that movie Sniper. They made the movie, and he got shot by the guy who, off TDY. I think he'd been sectionated and in other words, let out for mental stuff. And this Chris, I always do that, sorry. The American Sniper movie was made about him. And he would take this guy out shooting and the guy ended up killing him. Okay. And so, but the problem was this sniper was out bragging himself up. That makes the SEALs and the Rangers so angry. Because everything is teamwork. These guys get so arrogant, the ones that aren't thinking right. Okay, so they go mount themselves in some building somewhere, and they're covering everybody from a nice vantage point. Well, the only reason they can do that is they've got backup all around them, including eyes in the sky. And then they want to take all the glory because they can point a gun good. And they were trained right. And they might get a good instinct. But, you know, folks, that's not what it's about. And even more so is that general... The soldier from Butte, Montana, who claims, you know, to have shot Osama bin Laden. That is just malarkey. Special ops people despise that. It's teamwork. They go in like a caterpillar, elbow to elbow. You do not even ever have to worry about your back or your side. Because when you walk in, if you're point man, you're up front, you're going straight in. You've got guys shooting off covering your 45. You've got guys covering your 90s. And you've got guys covering your 6. The whole time, you're just covered. You don't worry. You just take care of your little zone. And then these guys, you know, that guy, Brian, whatever, he goes in and he apparently claims to have shot Osama bin Laden. Some other guys on the mission claim that he didn't have the critical bullet or whatever. Who cares? He should not be claiming, I shot Osama bin Laden. That is a complete lack of humility. It's terrible. The military put him in a situation where he got to pull the trigger. And if it's true, But it doesn't matter because it wasn't him. It's a team. That's the thing about leadership. You never, ever throw people under the bus. You never elevate yourself higher. You have humility. You trust God. He will pay you back. Okay? A friend of mine in legislature has had situations where he's written bills and other people have taken massive credit, all credit for it, and left him looking bad or frustrated him. That's okay because God will redeem you. God will pay you back. He knows when people are doing that kind of stuff, when people take the glory or people are misusing you. But what God watches for is your responses to those things. He wants to see how you react and how you respond. These things aren't accidents. It's weird. We live by faith, and I'm just as guilty. We live by faith, and then we walk by flesh. And then we get tested and towed and pulled and pushed, and we go straight to our flesh. And then we want to go deal with things ourselves. Folks, we're all, I mean, equally guilty. I know there's people that are just, you know, spiritually on their knees at all times. Boy, you know, that's amazing. And I appreciate that so much. But that can go the other way, too. I've been there. And I've been there in such a way that I've gotten, you lose your worldly calluses. I hate to say that, but it's true. You lose your earthly calluses. You got to have both. You really do. You gotta be able to dip in and out of the spiritual realm. You know, I guess basically it's like you're the instead of the X-Men, you're the Crossmen. You can go in and out of our reality into the spiritual and back, and you can handle both well. It's a bit like the Matrix or something. I don't know, but we can't get. You know, there's this terrible saying I hate so much where people go, "Oh, you're too heavenly minded to be any earthly good." I had someone say that to me once a long time ago when he was trying to pitch me Amway. And he was one that many years later, after, you know, God had told me what to do and I'd taken a lot of abuse from some people, and God, you know, brought the people back into my life when they had, you know, had major financial difficulties, and God had lifted us up and exalted us for honoring him and trusting him. And I'm not bragging, I'm just telling. And but it, you know, since then I've heard that saying, and you know, it's a really not the best saying. In a way, it's not accurate. We don't really become too heavenly minded to become earthly good. What happens is we become too earthly numb. We become detached. We isolate ourselves, and we only circle ourselves with people that, you know, make us feel good or whatever, or comfort us, or, you know, whatever it is. But we've got to stay strong. We've got to be out. I mean, if you disagree with me, look at Jesus. What areas did he really stay out of? I mean, near the end, he was kind of like, I can't go there. They're going to kill me. So I'm going to stay away for now. You know, that's different. I would hope you'd do the same. But in general, you don't avoid difficult situations. If you're one who cannot communicate, where you freak out or you yell or you can't admit fault or you can't be wrong, you know, then you need to get on your knees and study his word a lot, because that you cannot have the fulfillment of God on earth of his expectations and hopes for you without experiencing positive relationships and leadership roles. God gives us each a destiny. He gives us each talents. He gives us each a sphere of influence. If you're faithful with little, he'll give you much. Then what happens? To him who much is given, much is required. So once he gives you a bunch, you better be good steward with it, right? So let's cover Jocko Willink, Navy SEAL. I've got a list of his leadership attributes, and I'll just go through it. It's the end of a great, it's a really cool chapter. One chapter in his book talks about taking responsibility, and they had actually a live friendly fire event where they went out on a mission, and they misplanned something and didn't have the geography right and the layouts right. They had friendly fire, and they lost two Navy SEALs. They had to call their CO, who happened to be a general, and the general said, cease all operations now, and I'll be there soon. Well, they had to wait 36 hours for him to fly over to where they were from the U.S., and it was a long 36 hours. They went in a room. He brought brought himself, Master Sergeant, and three COs of the squadron leaders into the room. And the general said, he went around the room first and he asked the staff sergeants what happened. In each case, these first three staff sergeants, one by one, said, "It's my fault, sir." And they proceeded to explain what they had done wrong, what had gone wrong, and they begged to take full responsibility for it. Three guys in a row. They get to Jocko Wilnick, who's the master sergeant, and he says, "No, it's my responsibility. If I can take the glory when things are good, I'm going to take the consequences and responsibility when things go bad." That's leadership, okay? That's who we want to be. That's what we want to be. We don't run from our problems. We are not cowards. We know in Timothy, we are not given a spirit of fear. Now, I know people who've had trauma in their lives, they're fear bound, and they, you know, it boils down to whether or not they want to face the fear. Do they want to run to the fear or run away from the fear? Are they afraid people are going to find out things about them? Are they, what are they afraid of? They're afraid of authority. I mean, there's all kinds of things. Fear's wrong. God says, fear only God. What can man do to you? He also, but you got to balance everything else. He tells us to be articulate and smooth talkers, basically, in Proverbs, and kind and loving and gentle and faithful and, you know, all these things. So that when you're dealing with people, when you're going straight at people about a problem, you're very diplomatic, very kind, very loving, very gentle. When the Bible basically says run to your problems, it doesn't mean in an aggressive, hostile fashion. That there is also leadership. It's how you handle things. So, you know, the Bible gives us so many different examples of our spirit. You know, Philippians 2, it tells us, do nothing from rivalry or conceit, but in humility, count others more significant than ourselves. In humility, okay? Jesus in Matthew 20:25. Jesus called them to him and said, "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them." Keyword, lord it over them. Words, plural. I'm starting to talk like Biden. "And their great ones, you know, exercise authority over them." So it says, "You know the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them. And they, even their authority rule, exercise authority over them." In other words, bad behavior rolls downhill. "It shall not be so among you," Jesus says. He's creating his own army, the army of God. "But whoever would be great among you must be your servant. Whoever would be first among you must be your slave. Even as the Son of Man," Jesus Christ himself, "came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many." Now, Jesus, does he control us? He's God. But does he control us to become a follower of his? Or is it his leadership that brings us in? It's his leadership. Leadership, leadership, leadership. This applies so much to all of us, including parents. Parents, you got to lead. But I'll tell you what, you got to be a disciplinarian. Discipline is good. Tell yourself that. Biblical discipline is good. It means, you know, when the word discipline comes up in the Bible, it's talking of the equivalent of military training. That's what you want for your children. You don't over-punish them. Don't be the dad of the 16-year-old girl who's starting to come out of her shell and you want to ground her till she's 18 because you're afraid some guy's going to get a hold of her. No, you train her, you teach her, you talk to boyfriends if they're coming. You have meetings with them, you shake their hands, you make deals. You protect my daughter. You don't do this, you don't do that. That's how you handle it. You lead. You show that you love them. You build a cocoon around them. But you don't lock them up. I've seen this through history of being in churches and with kids and all this where, I mean, they're disheartened. I mean, think about it. Let's say you did something, you know, not too bad. You got, you know, you wrecked your car, right? Mistake. You were even being dumb. You didn't even look. You just rode right through a red light. And they go, "That's it. You're going to jail for 2.5 years. And you're like, "What? Yep, that's it. You're done." And you're like, "Wait a minute, don't I get a break? Don't I get a chance?" Nope, you're done. Well, at no point is that punishment going to serve you any purpose. You're going to be angry, hostile, destructive, rebellious, and the people who did that to you, you're going to hate. You're going to not like. We'll say that. Because you're a Christian. You don't hate, right? But you don't like sometimes, right? That's what you do to your kids. The punishment has to fit the crime. But do not be an enabler. And be consistent. And if you have a spouse that's completely inconsistent or a massive enabler, you got to stand up or get a counselor, or you got to do right, because your kids will go off the rails. I've watched so many over the years go down the same path from the same things. You can also be, I've made that clear, too strict, too rude, too unloving, too cold, too distant, not investing in the child, but wanting everyone else to, dropping them off at camps and little, clinics expecting the school to raise them and not discussing topics with them. They can go both ways. So here we go. We got a quick deal here. The dichotomy of leadership. A good leader must be, we're going to go fast now, confident. This is Jocko Willink, the almighty Navy SEAL. Confident but not cocky. Okay, we'll say arrogant because it sounds better on Christian radio. Confident but not arrogant. Courageous but not foolhardy. Okay, courageous but not nuts, crazy. You're not a kamikaze, but you're not afraid. Competitive but a gracious loser. Attentive to details but not obsessed by them. Okay, you see all the details and everything, but you're not OCD. Strong, again, a leader, we're reading the dichotomy of leadership. A good leader must be, this is a dichotomy, back and forth switch. Strong, but also have endurance, okay? So basically, a leader is strong, but it's not just boom, done, wimp, coward. That's an irrational emotional response. Consistency. And it all applies towards life, boxing is always a great analogy for life, but you can come in strong and powerful, and then a good boxer moves and slips and dodges and dives, and guess what? Fourth, fifth, sixth round come, you're sucking air, and they're beating you up. And that applies to every sport, football, basketball, all of it. A leader must be strong but have endurance, must be a leader. A leader must be a leader and a follower. So a good leader must be a leader and follower. We just read that. Jesus said, the first will be last, the last will be first, essentially. Whoever's great among you must be your servant. Whoever's first among you must be your slave. You know what, folks? Here's a key word. You need friends? Be a friend. Just go be a good friend. Don't try to impress people with your stories of nothingness. And even if you've accomplished incredible things, that's even worse because it intimidates people. Just be good. Be a servant. Keep it inside. I mean, I know people. I know a guy who's got a business who has the most decorated martial arts history probably in the world, and he's in our area. He won the All-World, the All-Tokyo, Full Contact, a bunch of stuff like this, crazy stuff, and he's just a builder now. Not just, but people that he works for, he does incredible work. They don't even know. He doesn't tell them. He's a great guy. Super good, gentle spirit, but he doesn't tell them. He's just got that background, and he doesn't tell them. That's the way we should all be. Humble, but not passive. Okay, don't confuse the two. Humility is not being passive. It's not ever standing by and letting evil prevail. He says aggressive, but not overbearing. So you're aggressive, but you're not just to the point where people are like, "Ooh, get away," Aggressive enough to lead, right? Quiet, but not silent. When you speak wisdom. Calm. This is effective leadership. Must be calm, but not robotic. Logical, but not devoid of emotions. You always have empathy as a leader. You're close with those beneath you, but not so close that one becomes more important than the another, or more important than the good of the team or group. And not so close that they forget who's in charge. That's one thing about parenting. Friendship, to a degree. Parenting is much more important than friendship. Don't worry about your kids being your best friend. It's better to be respected than liked. And so, and often as they get older, you can't. I'm not. I don't. I'm sorry if I sound cynical. I don't mean to. I'm just saying. I just know of a few situations where I'm seeing these kids going off the cliff one after the other in a couple families, and it's just kind of bothering me. And his last one is able to execute extreme ownership while exercising decentralized command. In other words, you take responsibility for everything within your realm, and not just to, you know, a higher authority, but just because that's who you are. You take responsibility. If there's something going on and you can do something about it, you do it. If you can't, then you move on. You know, if it's outside your realm, you move on. But you got to take responsibility where it comes your way. You're always looking to take responsibility. Excuse me. It's important. So many of us are like, I do not want to be in this situation. Why am I in this situation? Why do I have to deal with this person who's squatting in my house, or, you know, who's, you know, borrowing all my stuff, or I loaned my car and they won't give it back and they've beat it up. And I've seen all these things, right? You don't. Those are the times that we have to just be forthright and strong, and we've got to mold our own life. We're responsible to God for it. Okay. Financial. Here we are. Coins plus, right? Precious metal. Don't sit around and wait. Don't talk about what you coulda, woulda, shoulda. Just, and don't worry about, I wish I bought gold at 300 ounce or silver at $5 or $4. Doesn't matter. The brick wall. Rome wasn't built in a day. You build these portfolios brick by brick by brick. 401ks and IRAs. You know there's going to... One way to make sure you get a good portfolio is avoid catastrophic disaster. What goes up must come down. There's a lot going on. They're going to try to impeach Trump, all this crazy stuff. That could have dire effects on our economy. In fact, the Dems want that. They want to destroy it and destroy our lives just to get at Trump. It's not good. So... give us a call. We will help you be a good financial leader in your circle of influence. I'm whacking that mic today. And, you know, 444-0044 in Spokane. We build great portfolios. We'll take exceptional care. Make sure you tell them you want me involved in your portfolio. I will be personally involved. And get us some good reviews online. Get a free silver dollar. Take care. God bless. Have a great week. Bye-bye.